So I'm checking on that national ID card where states have to get this into effect sometime in 2008. It had been signed into law, but everybody seems to be fighting it still. This is going to be a very strange situation. The Mayan calendar, we've talked a lot about it as we lead up to it. That's one of the things we'll talk about with our special guest tonight, Jay Widener, along with other mysteries on this planet. So get ready for more on Coast to Coast AM. Jay Widener, an author, filmmaker, co-author of The Mysteries of the Great Cross of Henday, Alchemy and the End of Time, A Monument to the End of Time, and has produced and directed the documentary films 2012, The Odyssey, Secrets of Alchemy, Earth Under Fire, and many others. Jay previously produced and hosted the weekly radio show Mind Over Matters on NPR, where he interviewed a who's who of dynamic and important personalities. In 1996 and 97, Jay produced and hosted the Awakening to Gaia conferences in Boulder, Colorado. Now, these two conferences were designed to bring together many of the diverse scholars, authors, teachers interested in examining alternative historical and scientific theories. From 98 to 2000, Jay was the video development director for the Conscious Wave Productions, also in Colorado. And since 2000, Jay has been the president of Sacred Mysteries Productions, a company dedicated to producing quality films that challenge perceptions and help us understand the nature of reality. Currently in production on a feature film called Infinity. Jay, how's that film coming along?
Hey, that film's coming great, George.
Good, good. Is it going to be something that will keep our minds baffled?
Yeah, it's basically a film about death and life after death. We have Brian Weiss and Robert Thurman, Greg Braden, plethora of people are in the film and discussing probably the most important thing that any of us will face in our life, which is, of course, the end of our life. And I think it's going to be a very optimistic and positive view of a very important subject.
Did you come across, with all the work you did into this film, believing now, Jay, that there indeed is life after death?
Oh, I absolutely believe that there's life after death. I have absolutely no doubt about it. And I think that death is a doorway into a hyperspatial reality. And we come back and forth between this hyperspatial or hyperdimensional, as maybe Richard Hoagland would call it, reality, back and forth. And we come back to this earth many, many times. And we also go to many other worlds, I think. And there is no such thing as death per se. We're all infinite creatures, which is why we call it infinity.
Is this going to be a film like What the Bleep? Will we be able to see it at the theaters or DVD? How will we be able to watch it?
It will be at the theaters. It will be out probably by the end of this year. That depends on how big the budget gets. The budget seems to be growing daily. Right now we're talking with several artists about doing absolutely incredible animation of the death experience, so that on the big screen you will literally pass through the portal into the next realm. And we're trying to do that right, so it's going to cost quite a bit of money, and that might delay the film, but it will make the film a lot better. So we're really looking forward to getting that one on board. We've got investors who are really interested, and a lot of people are very interested in this film, and I think it's going to be probably the best thing that we've done yet.
Good for you, Jay. We've got lots to talk with you about tonight. I mean, a whole list of topics. But let's talk about what's coming up in the next several years. It's almost as if this program is gearing itself to December 21st, 2012 right now, which is, you know, maybe that's the next evolution of the program. Maybe it's the next evolution of all of us. The Mayan calendar ends, and I want to get your take on the significance of this date.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and, you know, I completely agree with you. I really feel that Coast is the perfect vehicle to explore the dynamics around this coming event. And a lot of people are poo-pooing the event, thinking that it's something like Y2K. I want to assure them tonight that this is going to be nothing like Y2K. This is not something that is up in the air. This is something very tangible, something that is absolutely happening right in front of our eyes. And I think most people, especially this audience, know that it's happening and can feel that it's happening. And so, yeah, I encourage you, George, I encourage you as much as I can to try to create a story arc around 2012 and get all the experts on, not just me or the other ones,
absolutely,
like John Major Jenkins or Richard Hoagland, but the rest of them, and get them on, and let's explore this thing thoroughly, because this is the story of our destiny. This is where we have been heading now for over 5,000 years, and this is the end of an age. It's not the end of the world. I don't want people to think that that's what we're saying. We're saying that this is the end of an age. This is the end of time as we know it. This historical period is coming to an end right now. And this is what everything that we see going on around us is really all about. The war in Iraq and 9/11 and every single thing that we're seeing is just the growing construct of the final resolution of this age. And it's incredibly fascinating. And what's most fascinating about it is that the Mayans and the alchemists and the Tibetans and the Peruvians and the Incans all predicted it thousands of years ago.
Absolutely. And you know, I look at this now one of several ways, and I keep going back and forth between myself. Maybe it's a combination of both. One is that this date might be the beginning of some kind of moment of enlightenment for all of us. Maybe something dramatic is going to happen to humankind and allow all of us to see something we've never seen before and to realize who we are as people and that we need to exist or we're going to all get destroyed eventually. So that's one thought. The other one is I think the Mayans were experts in solar information. And I think we might have some kind of major solar problem. Mm. And ironically, astronomers now and people who study the makeup of the sun are beginning to say that around 2011 or 2012, we can expect some huge solar disruptions. And I'm saying this is pretty darn ironic to be so close to the Mayan calendar 2012 date.
Absolutely. In fact, my mentor, Fulcanelli, the mysterious alchemist that I have spent my lifetime studying, and my book, The Mysteries of the Great Cross of Hendaye, which is about this cross in the south of France, both the monument and Fulcanelli are saying, and Fulcanelli wrote this in the 20s, and the Cross of Hendaye was built 400 years ago, both are saying that the sun is going to become extremely active at the end of this age. And so here we have a cross that is 400 years old saying exactly what you just said, George. And when I first realized what the cross was saying in the early 90s, I didn't believe it. I just frankly didn't believe it. And then, you know, about 1998, 1999, when those first summers started getting really toasty, that's when I began scratching my head and wondering, you know, oh my goodness, is there really something going on? And then by 2003, when that summer hit Europe and killed 30,000 people in France, the heat wave that lasted all through August, mm-hmm, that's when I said, you know, it really is happening, and it's happening in a big, big way. We were just in New York City last week, and it was 97 degrees in Times Square in early June. And it was so hot and so miserable that you could just feel the kind of, a leadening of the souls of everyone. And, you know, it is unusual. I talk to people and they tell me that this never happened before. If it did happen, it was very rare, but now it's happening all the time. And what's interesting about this is that, as you probably know, as your audience probably knows, the sun goes in cycles. It goes through a 22-year cycle. And this 22-year cycle is
11 off, 11 on, 11 off, right?
Right, solar maximum, and then 11 years to solar minimum, and then 11 years back to solar maximum. So the solar maximum, the last solar maximum, was in 1990. On September 11th, 1990, then-President George Bush made a speech in which he announced for the first time ever that there was something called a New World Order. Exactly 11 years later, at solar minimum, was, of course, the events of 9/11. Exactly 11 years later will be 2012. And guess what time the eclipse of the center of the galaxy and the sun occurs on December 21st, 2012? 11/11. And so we see there's a strange connection between solar cycles, events here on the Earth, and makes you scratch your head and wonder if maybe Arthur C. Clarke wasn't right when he said there was some kind of overmind, some kind of intelligence that seems to bind the Earth and predict and create events down here on the ground that we can only see the shadows of. And so we see the shadows of these things, and we think, you know, we don't know what they are, and we talk about them, especially on Coast, trying to figure out what they are. And what they really are is this huge event that's slowly unfolding in front of our eyes. And you're absolutely right. The sun is playing a huge part in this. And I would say, you know, the summers are going to get hotter and hotter.
See, and either one of three things happened here with the Mayans and the other civilizations. And one is either ancient knowledge and technology was so much more advanced than we think. They possessed the tools and the ingredients to make whatever discoveries and predictions that they have made. They had extraterrestrial help. Or, as you say also, Jay, they've tapped into something in the universe, maybe under some kind of meditation, which gave them knowledge of the future. I don't know. Could be one of the three, because I don't think it was a lucky guess.
No, I don't think it was a lucky guess. I think it might be even a combination of all three, actually. And we may be a much more important species in this universe than we've been led to believe. And I firmly believe this. I believe, as all alchemists believe, that the human being is the culmination of universal experience, and that we are the most important thing that the universe has ever created. The human brain is the most complicated single system in the entire universe that we know of. And there is something incredibly important about the human experience and about where we are headed. And when we're, I don't want to say we're being watched, although the Bible tells us that we are being watched, but we are being guided, or we're being like a gardener almost with a garden. And I don't.
We're
know
being cultivated.
Well, we could be being cultivated. I know Whitley Strieber certainly believes that, and it could be true. The Gnostics, of course, believe that there was a harvesting of souls at the end of time, and. I'm not sure it is that, or as much as it is maybe the fragmentation of the human soul will cease to a certain degree and will become more holistic as we approach 2012. And I think that that's actually happening. I think that we can see that people, the internet and Coast to Coast and many other things seem to be intertwining reality and creating a fabric that is more whole, and we are beginning to understand that everything we do has ramifications in all directions, and we're beginning to understand that people are pretty much the same everywhere on Earth. And
well, or, Jay, will it be like this? We'll have a cast of a lot of people on this night. It's a Friday night, by the way, December 21st, 2012, and, you know, it's going to be the night we're going to be here on the air. No vacation time for any of our staff members on that day. With various guests, yourself included, you are welcome to join us. Might it be something, because number one, how do we know the date is accurate? I mean, it was basically interpreted, right?
No. Actually, I can't say we're 100% sure, but we're 900.
I mean, we know about the winter solstice date is December 21st, but how do we know about 2012? How do we know
because
it's really not 2010 or 2014?
That's a very good question, and I really, really want to thank you for giving me a chance to answer, because I get that question so many times in my life that I'm really glad I'm being given a chance here to answer it. The Mayans didn't count by years. They counted by days. And they said, and of course I'm going to forget the number of days, it's 1 million, some incredibly long figure of days that their calendar runs, okay? And we know the date that it began. Okay, mm-hmm. And so the Mayan scholars have just counted the days forward. They haven't paid any attention to our Gregorian calendar at all. They've just counted the days, and they've ended up at December 21st, 2012. This is what prompted when John Major Jenkins was doing his work in the early 90s, of course, the first computer astronomy software programs were just coming out at the time.
Right.
And so he became the first guy to actually type in, you know, December 21st, 2012, and look at it on the software, on the Voyager software, and he saw that the center of the galaxy was lining up with the early morning sun, and he realized then that the Mayans were not just picking some random dates, but they were watching an event in the sky and then projecting forward to when this date would happen, which would be, of course, the alignment of the center of the galaxy with the sun at 11:11 on December 21st, 2012.
Great information.
That shattered everything because everything suddenly began to make a lot more sense in all these disparate fields of research. The cross of Henday suddenly appeared to be marking the same period of time because the cross of Henday is configured in a way in which the pedestal is lined up with the cross above. There is a great cross in the sky at the same exact time that this alignment is happening. In other words, the four signs of the zodiac, the four fixed signs of the zodiac, Aquarius, Scorpio, Taurus, and Leo, are all at 90-degree angles to the center of the galaxy. And Falconelli, one of the things that people, astrologers, have problems with is trying to figure out when one sign ends and another sign begins. And what Falconelli was telling us is that you use the center of the galaxy as your axis point. And when you understand that that's the dividing line between the ages, then you realize that the alignment that started in around 1980 and finishes up around 2018, of which the Mayans just picked the 2012 date as their kind of midpoint date, that is the shift into the age of Aquarius. And then this allowed us to see that the zodiac was, in fact, this gigantic 26,000-year-long calendar. And we are now entering into the age of Aquarius, which we last entered 26,000 years ago, the last time that the galaxy rose with the solstice sun.
Is it going to creep up on us, Jay, or is it going to hit us, whatever it is,
date? It's here right now. That's what I think. I don't think it's going to creep up on us. I think it has crept up on us. I think that we, in a sense, have been blindsided by our modern culture, and our politicians really haven't done a very good job either in preparing us for what's about to happen. And I would like to get into some of those things tonight because this is a tangible thing. There are real events that have never happened on Earth before.
Okay, let's talk about some of those events, Jay, and we've still got a lot of time.
Yep.
To get into the Denver airport and the Georgia Guidestones and some other incredible mysteries, even before we get to phone calls with you. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Jay Widener. We're here with Coast to Coast AM. Jay, we were talking about the possibilities and what leaders should be doing to at least prepare us. Go ahead. I'll let you pick that up.
Yeah, there's a great book. I think you've actually had the guy on your show, James Kunstler, talking about the long emergency.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
You know, we are headed towards a world where the oil supplies are going to be dwindling. And interestingly enough, the geologists say that the the year that this is really going to make an impact on us is, of course, 2012. And I think that people have to start realizing what kind of world is going to be when there is no more oil, and or at least a lot less oil than there is. And we're really, the politicians really are not even talking to us about it, nor are they creating any contingency plans for this eventuality. And since all of our farming and all of our food and everything that we have in this world relies on oil, when we come out the other end of this thing where oil supplies have dwindled down to nothing, we're going to be in for a very, very, very big shock. And where I am personally optimistic about this, I think that the human race will persevere and will actually be better off. I still think that the transition period is going to be extremely rough. And so this is a real, true event that's happening right in front of us. And this is the reason that we're in Iraq and why we're thinking about attacking Iran and all of these things, because we're, frankly, trying to grab control of the last major supplies of oil. And I just received an email from James Kunstler the other day. Oil exports from Mexico are down 18%. Oil exports from Saudi Arabia are down 15%. And so this is a tangible thing. It's one of the reasons why we made the film 2012, The Odyssey, was we were trying to get some of this information out in a way that was responsible and could show people that there is a way out of this mess, and to maybe point people in a direction that is a little more positive than some of the peak oil disaster scenarios that are going around. And I don't think it's going to be a disaster, but I do think it's going to be a really tough transition.
Okay, with all this said and done, I saw Apocalypto on DVD a week or so ago. And, you know, assuming some of the things Mel Gibson had in that film were accurate, the Mayans were a pretty brutal civilization. How could a civilization, Jay, that might have been so brutal and sacrificing and horrible things like that, how could they have been so enlightened to do what they were doing about 2012?
Well, you know, I really actually liked Apocalypto a lot, and I think Mel Gibson is one hell of a filmmaker. And but I think he may have gone a little bit over the top in his presentation about the Mayans, although we do know that they were...
They did sacrifice, right?
Yes, they did. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, we could look at our culture and say that we have the largest amount of people incarcerated, we have the highest murder rates in the world, and say that we are a backwards culture. But this is also, of course, the same culture that gave us, you know, computers and Stanley Kubrick and all sorts of incredible things. So I think that, you know, societies have a strange bifurcation where, you know, you can have one half of society being incredibly brutal while the other half of the same society can be incredibly enlightened. We know the Greeks were a brutal people, and yet they had many enlightened people like Pythagoras. So the English, too, you know, while they're producing Shakespeare, they're beginning to conquer the New World, the United States, and killing Indians and things. So I don't really think that what the leaders of the Mayan people were doing as important as what their scientists and their priests were doing, which was exploring the quality of time. And I think that of all the things that the Mayans left us, that definitely was their most important legacy. And I think the point of Apocalypto, which is a very interesting point, and kind of talks about what we're talking about here, is that societies reach this apocalyptic moment. And in that apocalyptic moment, they have a choice. And the choice, of course, that Gibson presents is the Spanish missionaries and the convertant to Christianity. But in that moment, we can transcend our problems. You know, it's like water boiling in a pan on the stove. You know, it boils furiously, and then it transcends itself into steam, and it escapes its harsh reality and turns into something different. And that's where we're headed. We are water boiling on the stove right now, and we are about to transcend into something completely different than what we were before, and this is what the Mayans were watching. And it should also be said that the Mayan calendar was developed thousands of years before the events that are depicted in Apocalypto. So,
isn't it amazing, Jay, how mainstream science, though, hasn't picked up on the 2012 date and some of its ramifications?
Yeah, it is. Science, you know, ideas move through four phases. The first, when an idea first appears, the mystics are generally the ones to first pick it up. The second group of people that pick up an idea are the artists, and the third group that picks up an idea are the scientists, only after the mystics and the artists have been blabbing about it for a long time. And the fourth people to pick up an idea are the last, of course, are the politicians. And so science is catching up to a lot of the mystical, artistic foment of the last 100 years with quantum physics and a lot of things, but they're still lagging far behind when it comes to their understanding of the knowledge that our ancient ancestors possessed. And they really are quite prejudiced against our ancient ancestors, thinking that they were eight cavemen living in caves and living short, brutal lives, when in fact they were people just like us. They had brain sizes the same as we did. They lived on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years, and although they may not have had technology, but they may have, they definitely developed extrasensory powers and perceptions that have atrophied for us in our modern world. And we talk about this in 2012, The Odyssey, about how we are losing our sense of who we are. And I think it's going to be 2012 is sort of the shock wake-up call that's going to return us back to who we are, really are, and we are going to go back to what we were, but this time we're going to go back with all of this incredible knowledge that we've gained through the course of the last 5,000 years of the Long Count calendar, which is, of course, also called history. And so history is the initiation of the human species, taking 100,000 years of hunter-gatherer incredible extrasensory powers, and then developing technologies, communication skills, language, writing, art, singing, dancing, radio, and then we're going to transcend this environment and go back to a slightly more primitive lifestyle, possibly, but with all of this knowledge intact. It's what Terence McKenna would call the archaic revival, and it's really where we're headed with this whole thing. And I think that this oil depletion is all part of this long-term plan by other powers that are guiding us along here and making sure that we don't blow ourselves up and making sure that we do things right. And frankly, you know, we've had nuclear weapons since 1945, and we haven't really used them yet. Not really.
Well,
we used a couple times.
If you're Japanese, you won't agree.
Yes, but I mean, we should have wiped ourselves out with the number of mistakes that human beings are prone to make, and you know, all these missiles pointed at each other. So it could be said that there might be other forces guiding us into a concrescence of at the end of history, and I think that is what's going on. And so, you know, I'm a short-term pessimist, but I'm actually quite an optimist, and I think I really think that we're not only going to make it, we're actually going to be quite an amazing species when we come out the other end of this thing, which I don't think is going to be that long from now. I think it's going to be around 2020. I think around 2018, 2020, we are actually going to solve many of the problems that we're facing right now.
Let's move on to Elberton, Georgia.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Georgia Guidestones. What are we talking about this monument?
Well, the Georgia Guidestones first came to my attention when I was writing the book on the Cross of Henday. And it struck me because from looking down from the air at the Georgia Guidestones, they look like a gigantic cross or a gigantic X. And the Cross of Henday has this kind of cross X motif also going through it. And so I got interested, and then I found out the history, which we explain in our movie, 2012, The Odyssey, that they were built by this anonymous man named R.C. Christian, who came to Elberton, Georgia in 1980, right, by the way, right when the beginning of the galactic alignment is starting, and had this incredibly huge monument, it's called America's Stonehenge, built on a flat.
He commissioned it? He had to pay somebody? Okay.
He paid somebody to build it, a granite company in Elberton, and it was incredibly expensive. Huge slabs of granite standing 15, 20 feet tall, a foot and a half thick, and engraved on the stone, he put like 10 new commandments, 10 new guidelines for humanity. And since we can see that the Georgia Guidestones aren't going to go anywhere for a long, long time, we can see that these 10 guidelines, which are written in 8 different languages, are somebody's message to us on what is about to happen to us. Now, a lot of people, Christian fundamentalists, there's a man named John Connor, are actively attempting to have the Georgia Guidestones taken down and destroyed. And the reason that they're doing that is because they believe that this has been foisted by the Illuminati or the New World Order.
You never know.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things, of course, they say that's, I guess, troubling to a lot of people, the very first thing that the Georgia Guidestones say is that they want to maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Now, that means 11 out of 12 people on the planet right now aren't going to be here when this happens.
That's right.
Yeah, and so this is a haunting thing. And it causes a lot of people to get very, very uncomfortable. It's the one uncomfortable thing that people get from our film 2012, The Odyssey, is this scene at the Georgia Guidestones because of that single fact. The rest of the things that are on the Georgia Guidestones are actually much more benign, you know, guide reproduction wisely, unite humanity with a living language, rule passion, faith, and tradition with tempered reason. These are all things we can agree on, you know, protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts. But we get to that one sticker, which, of course, is the first thing, and we all know that in the Ten Commandments or in the Bill of Rights, the first one is really the most important one, whether it's you shall have no other gods before me or everybody has the right to the freedom of religion and freedom of speech. So this is a troubling thing, and again, I don't know who R.C. Christian is, but we do know.
Think he's still alive? Who knows, right?
I think that R.C. Christian probably been alive for a long time. I think R.C. Christian is a member of a society that where its members actually may live to be 300 or 400 or 500 years old, and they've been with us for a long time. And I think that just the name R.C. Christian implies this because R.C. is also the initials for Rosicrucian, and we know that the society has Rosicrucian links.
Well, here's some of the things, Jay, that some of them you've mentioned. I want to go through the list so everybody can get a perspective of what these guidestones mean because they do sound Illuminati.
Yep.
Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. Unite humanity with a living new language. Rule passion, faith, tradition, and all things with tempered reason. Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts. Let all nations rule internally, resolving external disputes in a world court. Avoid petty laws and useless officials. Balance personal rights with social duties. Prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. Be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. Leave room for nature. Some of these sound pretty good, don't they?
Well, they do, except that I guess this is the problem that a lot of the people who are against them have is, well, who gets to dictate these rules? And the second one, which is really more important, who decides who the 11 out of 12 people are that don't get this great world
exactly
that they're making? And so this goes back to this old idea that's battered around by a lot of my friends and other people, that there's like this war going on, a kind of an occult war between a group called the Illuminati and another group. They're the owls and the roosters. And the owls want to keep us asleep, and the roosters want to wake us up. And, of course, we know that at the Bohemian Grove, there's a gigantic owl, Moloch the owl. And so we see that maybe the Georgia Guidestones were actually built by a rooster who decided he couldn't break his oath to the larger group unless he did it anonymously, and he was trying to get us to understand that these are our plan, their plans for us. And I actually choose that explanation. I've seen enough evidence, and some of the other things we're about to talk about is more evidence of the roosters. The owls aren't saying anything, but the roosters are saying things. It's just that you have to decipher what they're saying, and you have to dig deep to find out what they're saying, because they are constrained by oaths. Folcanelli says over and over in his book, Mystery of the Cathedrals, that he can say no more because he is constrained by oaths. And I think Folcanelli was a rooster. And so the owls and the roosters are the two groups that are, they're all in the same group, but one group, the roosters, I don't know, they feel compassion for us, or they think that maybe we have a right to know what's being planned. And so they're creating these monuments, the Cross of Hende, the Gothic cathedrals, the Mayan calendar maybe even. And this is what's going on. And I think that a lot of the things that Richard Hoagland has discovered about NASA shows that there seems to be a group within NASA who are the roosters, who are trying very hard and assiduously to tell us things that are going on, leaking photographs. I worked with Richard all through the 90s on some of the moon stuff.
And well, he thinks the world of you, Jay.
Pardon me?
He thinks the world of you.
Oh, yeah. Well, he and I were both born on April 25th, and we're almost like brothers. And the dangest things would happen to us, you know, strange photographs would be sent to us and odd messages left on phone machines. And after a while, you just had to conclude that there was a group that was assisting us. And the same thing happened with the Cross of Hende work. Over and over, odd books would be sent to me anonymously. Strange things would happen.
All right. You hold the line, Jay. We'll be right back with you. We're going to talk a little bit more about this and also the mysteries of the Denver airport. Jay Wiedner is our guest. Jay's website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Jay, let's take some time to talk about the Denver International Airport. Firestorm of people talking about this thing. It was built in 1995 on 34,000 acres, which is 53 square miles. It is in spite of the fact that Denver already had what everyone thought was a perfectly fine airport at Stapleton, which was closed. What do we know about all this?
Well, you know, I lived in the Denver area from 1996 to 2000, And I became intensely interested in the whole subject. And in the film 2012, The Odyssey, Sharon Rose actually goes there, and we show the murals and the plaque that's at the Denver airport. But there's a lot more than what we showed. And as I got into looking into the Denver airport, a couple of times I met guys, you know, that install drywall and do painting and things like that. And they told me that they would be taken to the Denver airport, and they would go down these huge freight elevators that would go down and down and down and down, and they would end up in this huge underground complex where they would do work. And they asked, you know, for me not to tell anyone their names, but I could tell their stories.
Absolutely.
And so as I got into investigating this, I began realizing that the Denver airport is part of a thing called COG, which means continuity of government. And because Denver is sort of close to the center of the country, it was equidistant for anyone to fly to if, say, they had to fly somewhere in an emergency. And so it was pretty much equal from, say, Seattle or New York or Florida or wherever to get to the Denver airport. And my feeling, and I have a lot of good evidence to back this up, is that there are trains running underground from the Denver airport into shelters inside the Rocky Mountains.
And maybe cities.
Yeah, that's what I think. And they may even go beyond the Rocky Mountains. They may go all the way down into New Mexico. The Taos Hum, which was around the same time that the Denver airport was being constructed, is very likely tunneling equipment under the ground that was going under Taos, New Mexico, heading towards another underground base at Dulce. And I think that there is it's a perfectly logical thing for government to do, to try to find a way to protect itself in case of an emergency.
If that's the real reason, Jeff.
If that's the real reason, exactly.
Let me tell you something, too, because I have a friend whose sister used to work at the Denver airport, and she used to see military types going into these areas, these tunnels, these shafts, and not coming back out.
Yes, I've been told the same thing. I'll tell you a little story that I when I was living in the area, I was going to work every day at a very large corporation, and I was listening to a rock and roll radio show. This was the same time that the X-Files movie Fight the Future was coming out, and they had Conspiracy Week on this rock and roll radio station, right? And so they had their local conspiracy theorist on, and he was discussing local conspiracy theories. And one day, the third day of this promo, they actually called up the head of the Denver airport unexpectedly, on live on the air, and asked him if the Denver airport had a secret base under it. And the guy literally blew his cork.
Really?
On the radio, slammed the phone down.
Stammering and stuttering.
Oh, he was as angry as a hornet's nest in August. And slammed the phone down, and the end of the promo. They never had the promo on anymore after that. And so you get this kind of abrasive reaction every time you bring it up. It's interesting because Frederico Pena, the mayor of Denver at the time, of course, became Clinton's Secretary of Transportation. Everyone associated with the airport, which ran billions of dollars over budget, became huge in the government in all sorts of odd ways that are very disconcerting. And so what is the Denver airport? I think there's a curious thing in the Denver airport. At one point in the airport, if you look up, you'll see a gargoyle. And it's in an odd place on the north end of the airport, and it's actually hard to find. And I noticed it one day, and I looked, and there was a little plaque on the wall under the gargoyle, and it said, Norter Denver. And so I guess that was the name of the gargoyle work of art. Well, that's interesting because Fulcanelli tells us that the number one palace of this group of esoteric people, of course, is Notre Dame. And here we have a gargoyle, which is, all, of course, all over Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, here in the Denver airport, and it's called Notre Denver. And so my feeling is that the Denver airport is some kind of cathedral to these guys, a cathedral to the world that they're making. And so the murals, which we show in the film, are a story. If you look at the murals exactly in the way that we present them.
Like a message? Or are they trying to tell us something?
They are.
Or are they trying to put it in our face?
They are trying. Again, it could be the roosters, or it could be somebody just trying to put it in our face, as you say. But, you know, one of them is three people in coffins surrounded by all of these extinct animals. The Quetzal bird plays a big part in this mural, which is, of course, the bird that the Mayan god Quetzalcoatl was named after. So there's this extinction message in one of them. In another one, all the children of the world are gathered around a gigantic psychedelic plant of some kind, and they're all extolling that. They're all going. All the races are going to live together in a world of peace.
It's like the one world government bylaws.
Yes, it's in fact it dovetails exactly in which we do in the film with the Georgia Guidestone.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the end of the scene, Sharon Rose, the narrator of the movie, actually walks up to the plaque commemorating the men who built the airport, and there, right on the plaque, is a Freemasonic sign. The square and the compass with the G, and of course just earlier in the film the editor of the Alberton Star tells us that the people who built the Georgia Guidestones were Freemasons. And so here we have two things, and if we add Fulcanelli telling us that the cross of Hende was built by a master mason, now we have three things, all concerned with some kind of event that's going to happen. That's if to follow the murals at the Denver Airport, if we're to follow them in the way that they're saying, is going to be, you know, a real nail biter, to put it bluntly. So we see, and I want to mention that the last of the murals, which is the most troubling of all the murals, shows a Gestapo-type man walking down a street that is where the cities are on fire, and he's knifing the Dove of Peace with his bayonet.
Oh, my. What is that doing at an airport?
I cannot tell you. I have no idea. It is, and this is not like cartoonish art. This is Leo Tanguma, who is a Mayan, by the way, is the artist of these things, and he is an excellent artist. This art is excellent. And kind of a funny aside on this whole thing, when we were shooting the scenes in the Denver airport, we didn't have permission, and we were a little bit worried that we were going to get in trouble. And so right on the film, while we're shooting, a policewoman walks up and asks Sharon Rose what we're doing, and she tells him that we're filming these things, and the policewoman says, "Oh, that's fine. Everybody can film them if they want." So it's like they don't really care that this is all getting out, and it's right Maybe. There in front of us. A million people walk by those murals every
Well,
six
I tell you what we do. When we open up the phone lines next hour, Jay, I'll also open up a Denver hotline. Those people
good.
Listening to us on our number one rated KHOW, I'll give you a special number if you know of anything unusual going on at the airport. Now, listen to this. There's a website called Anomalies-Unlimited, and they interviewed someone by the name of Alex Christopher several years ago. At least they posted that on their website. Listen to the answer to this question. The question was, you would think that during this massive construction, they would not be able to keep this stuff secret. Here's the answer. I think a lot of people saw things that disturbed them so much that they would not talk about it. I know several people who worked on the project that managed to find their way down into the depths, probably close to the deep underground base, and saw things that scared them so badly they won't talk about it. I interviewed a few of the former employees on these construction crews that worked out there on these buildings that ended up buried, and they're afraid to talk. They say that everyone is real nervous about it, and they decided to tell some of the secrets that they knew, but they don't want anybody to know who they are, like you just said. So I can tell you that it is very unusual and spooky kind of place. And if you are a sensitive person, you get nauseated as soon as you enter the perimeter of the airport, especially when you go down underground. You become very nauseated, nervous. This is also because there's so much electromagnetic flux in the area that if you get out in the open ground around the airport, you will buzz. Well, where does this flux field come from? I think that it's coming from some kind of underground electrical system. Because we were there, there were no power lines, and the whole place was just buzzing with this free energy floating around. It's very unusual. Really weird stuff. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it really is. And I don't think that there's anything really weirder than the Denver airport. The whole edifice is just so bizarre. And the I knew a person, again, when I was doing my investigations, who actually talked to the one of the lead guys involved in the construction of the airport. And he told her, and this was in 94, that the airport was $15 billion over budget, and they weren't going to tell anybody.
Well, let's assume for a moment, though, Jay, that let me let you finish. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. Go ahead. It's just that what I'm saying is that they knew that this thing wasn't going to cost anywhere near the small pittance that they said it was going to cost, and they didn't care. And then, of course, you raises the question, well, where did the $15 billion come from? I mean, Colorado is a fairly wealthy state, but it doesn't have that kind of money. And so is it the federal government? Who funded this, and why did it cost just these? It's just a big tent with some concrete runways. Why did it cost nearly $20 billion to build and construct? And we know that is probably only the tip of the iceberg. It probably, if what we suspect is going on there, it's probably a $1 trillion facility at least. And so there's other things. There's people who have done aerial photographs of the area, and there's these strange buildings about every 4 miles.
Are these called like berms?
No, the berms are outside the runways, and that's a whole other interesting thing. We couldn't figure out what these strange buildings were. They seemed like they looked like houses from the outside, but they seemed to have, well, I'll just say it, they had vents in the ceilings of the house, on the ceilings, the roofs of the house had these vents. And then we realized, of course, that this was where the air was escaping from the tunnel systems for the trains. And you can actually follow the line, and it goes right into the Rocky Mountains.
Let's assume for a moment, let's take the sinister approach, that years ago, the power brokers on this planet, we call it the Illuminati for lack of a better phrase, decided that there were two main things they had to accomplish on this planet. One was population control, controlling people, and the other was reducing the population. They saw the planet starting to use its resources, and they said, and they probably have actuarial tables, they probably said, we can't support 6.5 billion people, soon to be 9 billion people. We can support quite well for almost an endless amount of time, 500 million, if we keep it at that level. We want to have a one-world government. But we're going to do it all with 500 million people. Now, the plan is twofold. One is, how do we get rid of the 500 million, the rest of the billion, right? The 6 billion people and keep the 500 million. And then, where are we going to go when the calamity occurs? So let's assume they decided to build structures like the Denver airport, where down below, 100,000 people might be able to live very comfortably for a year or two or three, while the rest of the people on the planet bake and cinder. if you believe in a sinister theory, then you have to take it the full way and believe that what these facilities are doing underground are to prepare themselves for this horrible, horrible apocalypse.
I would have to say that I do not disagree with anything that you've just said. I think that that's about the most succinct analysis I've heard of the situation. I think that's pretty much exactly what they're doing. I think a few of them escape out and try to give us messages about this, and, you know, God love them for that. And that's why I say that, you know, it's time for us to start taking care of ourselves, because I think, you know, even like Katrina showed that they're cutting us loose. They don't really want to help us anymore. And when Katrina happened, we were living in the city of Seattle, and I just got out. You know, I moved out into the woods because I realized that I do not want to be in Seattle when a calamity happens, because I know that the federal government is not going to be there to help us, just like they weren't there in Katrina and New Orleans. And so, yes, I think that that is fairly obviously the scenario that is about to unfold, and we have to do what we can to inform each other about what this is, what is about to happen, and to do everything we can to avert this. And, you know, human beings are the greatest resource that this planet's ever created. I agree that the environmental strains are severe, but who gets to say who lives and who dies, and by what right and what divine right do they have to make this decision? And I think that's really probably the main reason that we, that Sharon and I made 2012 the Odyssey, was to evoke this message out there that there is some funny business going on, and it's up to us to decide who and what we want to be and do in the next few years as we approach 2012. Interesting.
Well, the elitist, Jay, will be the ones, but they're going to need to have millions of workers to continue to fulfill their mission after it's done.
Yes. So that would seem to be that there's only really going to be maybe 50 million elitists and 450 million workers, right? Something.
Well,
like that.
I'm not sure about that, though, because I think the elitists will then panic, thinking that the workers one day will overthrow them.
Absolutely. And, of course, if these elitists are this kind of bloodthirsty types, they're going to go after each other also. how can they really trust each other even when they've just committed such a holocaust? And so they also have to deal with that. I mean, there's a high level of treachery that would be going on at the top that would seem to create a very chaotic situation. So this thing is not written in stone. This thing is not already decided. It's a plan.
All right, stay with us, Jay, because I want to ask you the question that has to be asked when we come back. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, plus a special hotline for those of you in Denver listening on KHOW. If you know anything about the Denver airport, the strange things, check in with us. And we'll be back in a moment with Jay Widener on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Jay, I must ask you this question then, the one that needs to be asked, and that is, in your opinion, when you look at what's happening to the planet today, the fact that we are eating up resources, I still think global warming is a cycle, but we are polluting the planet. We're taking more food. I don't know if we're going to be able to make food for the rest of this planet. There's starvation everywhere. We have wars. We have all kinds of problems. Is it necessary to reduce the planet down to 500 million? Is it smart business to do that? I'm not talking about popular business or what's right and wrong. Is it smart business to do that?
Well, that's a question that I've been asking myself for a long time. And, you know, I'm on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I'm pretty sure it's smart business on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. I don't want to be one of the 11 out of 12 who are going to get it.
Well, I know. That's not the question, though. The question is just based on what we know, is this the right thing to do for the savior and survival of the planet?
Well, I'll tell you what. Here's what I really think, and I hope that you don't think this is a cop-out, but I think that we have a destiny, and I don't think that it is up to managers to decide what and who gets to live and who gets to die. So, and I think that our destiny is much bigger than us in our little constrained three-dimensional worlds can really understand. I guess this is what alchemy is really about. It's about changing lead into gold, and I think that the human race is the kind of like the mind of the planet, and I think that the planet can sustain any number of people, but it just depends on what kind of lives we're living. If we're living lives where we're consuming the entire planet, then for sure these guys are right. If we're living a life of a much more constrained materialistic view and a more spiritual view, then I think the planet can sustain this population. And I think that's really what's going on. I think that human beings are the greatest resource the Earth has ever created. And I think the Earth is rolling the dice on us. And it's saying, this is what I've been working for billion years, and I'm not going to let these people blow it, because the Earth has finally created a being that is conscious, that can look back at itself, at its own being, and understand what it is. And so Thomas Malthus is the British philosopher who said that most of the people on the planet were what he called useless eaters, and a lot of this philosophy seems to drive a lot of fascism and Nazism and even communism, and I think that it's essentially an anti-spiritual, anti-dimensional, meta-dimensional point of view, and it doesn't really realize who we really are, that we really are a much bigger and better species than we're being told. And if we're to believe the mystics, then we're about to transcend this whole experience and turn into a new species, and then none of the things that we're talking about really is going to matter. And so that's the war between, I guess, the bad guys and the good guys. The good guys are trying to turn us into a new evolved, not really evolved, but a new species of almost pure consciousness. And the bad guys are just materialists who don't see any of this, and they just want to make sure that there's a place for them to live, and so they've decided to get rid of us. And this is the great war at the end of time that's predicted in the book of Revelation and many other prophecies, of which we get into in the film 2012. And the Inca elders told us that we're turning into a new species called Homo luminus, or the man of light, or the human of light. And so consciousness, Teilhard de Chardin, a famous French mystic, said that consciousness is actually what's evolving on this planet, and that it needs the human being, because we are the most conscious beings, to accomplish this task. And so there's a greater task that has nothing to do with managing resources or any of that, and I think that's really where we're headed. You know, they've been trying to kill us off for a long time, and human beings are tenacious. They don't go quickly.
And, no.
I don't think we're going to go quickly, and I think that they know that we're not going to go quickly, and we frustrate them. We frustrate them by talking about these things, by knowing about these things, by the signs that the roosters are leaving behind for us to see. And we're more conscious now than we were a few years ago, thanks to coast and the Internet, basically. And we're growing more and more aware every day. And soon this thing is going to reach an exponential level that is going to turn into steam. The boiling water is going to turn into steam, and we're going to turn into something that we don't know what yet. But it's coming, and it's coming really, really fast. And so I'm not one to follow the dictates of bean counters and managers. Pretty much they're heartless and don't realize, you know, the beauty of human nature. You know, Beethoven was the 13th child of his family. He was crippled. He had several diseases, and a heartless person might have aborted Beethoven or left him to die, and we would have lost all of his great music. And so each human being has a potential to create incredible beauty and greatness, and I don't think we should leave it up to the dictates of bean counters and managers to tell us who the people are that are going to live and who the people are that are going to die.
Okay, well, then let's look at this, Jay, with a different twist. Let's assume they're not going to kill 11 out of 12. Let's assume they're aware of a calamity that could kill 11 out of 12, and they want to save themselves, but they're not going to tell us. Possible?
Very, very possible. More likely than any of the other scenarios, I would say. My own research has shown that the Freemasons, not maybe the modern Freemasons, but the old Freemasons, one of their main goals is to look at the world and follow gigantic cycles of time. And one of the things that Hoagland and I discovered in our research in NASA was that there's a group of people in NASA who are interested in finding evidence of past disasters on other planets like the Moon and Mars and Saturn, because that evidence has not been touched by erosion, nature, and human beings, and so it's more pristine. And so they've gone to the Moon, and they've seen their meteor tracings, and they know that there was gigantic solar flares 13,000 years ago. There's no doubt about it.
You can still see the skip once the meteor hit, almost.
Exactly. They're watching this thing, and they are using all of the resources of our technology to perfect their calendars so that they know when these things are going to happen. You know, Al Gore's movie, Inconvenient Truth, well, the science isn't very good. But, you know, Al Gore is a highly connected person. His daughter is married to the Schiff family. These are pretty much the rulers of this world. And so maybe Al Gore is just trying actually just to warn us of something else. And he can't really do it straightforward, so he's using another avenue, i.e. global warming, to tell us that there is something imminent happening.
Or divert our attention.
Indeed, it's a very difficult game to discern who's saying what and why. And so I've kind of given up on the politicians and the pontificators, and I go look at the evidence and then draw my own conclusions, and the evidence is there in the Georgia Guidestones, in the Denver Airport, the Cross of Hende, the Mayan calendar, and ancient traditions which have been left untouched, for the most part, by corrupt practices of the media and politicians.
If you were a government leader and you knew a 10-mile-wide asteroid was coming this way, there's nothing we can do about it, and let's say it's 10 years out, but nothing we could do about it. So they start building facilities to hide, to take the impact of the planet. They're storing stuff, and maybe they think eventually we'll come back and what's left we'll live in. If not, we'll live in this underground thing if we have to. Would you, as a leader, Jay, tell the rest of us what was going on?
Honestly, probably not. Only because there'd be nothing we could do, and it would just cause a panic, and people would start probably killing each other and doing terrible things to each other. So, I mean, the point is well taken, and I understand the gravitas of their situation. And I believe that, you know, they know this to a certain degree. And I do believe that, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's an asteroid strike. I don't know if it's solar flares. I don't know if it's 100 other scenarios.
Well, if you tie it into the Mayans, it could be a solar flare, and maybe the date is 2012.
Well, that would certainly seem to coincide with the solar cycles. And don't forget, solar minimum was 2001. Well, or 2001 was a year with huge solar flares, and this is solar minimum. And so, you know, if we're having gigantic solar flares like we've never seen during solar minimum, what in the world is going to happen when we hit solar maximum in 5.5 years? And then, of course, you start wending your way backwards to exactly where this show tonight is almost exactly halfway between 9/11 and December 21st, 2012. And you can go back and say, oh, well, maybe 9/11 was really about a way to create a level of control so that the chaos that could ensue can be more easily controlled. And that might be the scenario behind the whole thing. So we don't know.
One of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes, 1961, called The Shelter, where a suburban dinner party is interrupted by a bulletin warning of an impending nuclear attack. Yeah. But the neighbors scramble to prepare themselves, but they turn against the one family that has installed a permanent bomb shelter. I think that's exactly what would happen. There would be panic. People would storm wherever they think these facilities might be by millions.
I'm afraid you're right. They would. And so, you know, it's great that we're talking about this, because every person needs to think about, you know, how they're going to handle these next few years, and to practice discretion. Maybe you shouldn't be announcing to the world that you have a bomb shelter or anything else. Maybe you should just keep it discreet and protect your family, because that's what every man should be doing anyway. And Rod Serling was a very prescient individual, and certainly predicted a very real thing in that episode, which is also one of my favorite episodes.
Strangely enough, Larry Gates died in 1996. He was 81 years old, died in Connecticut of leukemia. He was the one who was the Dr. Stockton who built that fallout shelter.
Right. And don't forget the other great Twilight Zone, the Monsters Are Alive on Maple Street, in which, you know, a complete panic ensues over a possible alien invasion. So, you know, these things are, it's funny that he's talking about these in the early 60s, because that's when these plans appear to have been concocted, whether it's the report from Iron Mountain or various other scenarios. They all seem to have been thought of just about that same time period. It's almost as if Rod Serling was connected to some kind of, you know, conscious meme that was emerging at the time. And so, I don't know, you know, these are great questions, and ones that are not easy to answer under any circumstances.
That's a great topic. I mean, this is very exciting. I can't wait for the phone calls for you, Jay, and also from Denver to see what we may get. But
yeah.
I don't think Denver is the only location for some of these underground taverns and things. You've heard of what's going on in, they'll say, New Mexico, right?
Yeah.
Lots of things going on there. So people there, though, think there's a reptilian tie-in. That's even stranger.
Well, and don't forget that the CIA is moving their headquarters to Denver, which is very interesting.
Uh-huh.
And, they're right now. They'll be done within the year. Their entire headquarters is moving from Langley, Virginia, to Denver. And so that speaks of something. And my own personal feeling is that, let's just say that none of this is real. Well, my own personal feeling is that Denver is going to be the capital of the North American Union, and that it's going to be the center. It's right between Canada and Mexico, and that's kind of the placid point of view of Denver. But yeah, I think that there's tunnels that are running all the way from DIA to Dulce, Mexico, New Mexico, and possibly into Arizona, Utah, Nebraska, and several other places, actually. And I think it's a whole network of underground tunnels. Richard Sauder goes into this quite effectively.
And the late Phil Schneider, too, right?
Yes, Phil Schneider. Now, there you go. How many people know about the story of Phil Schneider telling his story of a firefight in the caverns in Dulce, New Mexico, and then, of course, he died mysteriously a few weeks after he went public with this story. So there's all these strange scenarios running around, and, you know, it's the old story. It looks like a duck. It walks like a duck. At a certain point, you know, it's a duck, and that's all I can say about it. It's my feeling is that there is something going on, and I think it's part of this continuity of government. And, of course, Bush's recent NSAMs, his memos, his National Security Action memos, are somewhat troubling, too, because he's saying that he can pretty much take over with any emergency now. And so I think they're definitely afraid of something. That's all I can say. I don't know what it is, but they're definitely worried about something, and it isn't Osama bin Laden, although they are worried about him.
Take a minute. Tell us about your websites and things people can see or find for you.
Yeah, my website is jwidener.com, or the other site is sacredmysteries.com. We have our new movie out, which has been getting great reviews and showed all over the country, 2012 The Odyssey. Armageddon is not what it used to be. We have with Jose Arguelles and Greg Braden and John Major Jenkins and Alberto Villoldo and the Incan Elders, and we travel. Sharon Rose travels to the Denver airport, to the Georgia Guidestones, and all over the world. We have a sequel coming out called Time Wave 2013, of which we're going to go and show the tunnel systems that exist under Peru in the Andes, and an ancient tunnel system that's existed there for 20 to 40,000 years from previous civilization had built. And we have a great new film coming out called Star Dreams, which I'd love to send you, George. It's the ultimate crop circle film.
Sure. Send it to Los Angeles because I'll be back there in a few days.
I will send it directly. And it's a great film. It's the 2005 season. It's got Linda Moulton Howe and Richard Hoagland and a bunch of other people in it. So there's just a lot going on. And we're just trying to create kind of a ancient mystery school on DVD so that people, wherever they live, can partake of these mysteries and understand the wealth of knowledge that exists for all of us through the, you know, the human endeavor. And so that's really our goal at Sacred Mysteries. And we're going to keep going no matter what their plans are for us.
Well, we're going to keep going. We're going to take your phone calls next. And those of you in Denver listening to us on KHOW or XM, simply call this special topic line if you know about things going on at the Denver airport, 818-817-0021. That's 818-817-0021. Tonight, only high strangeness. Well, I just realized what Ross has said. Here I am talking about the Illuminati hiding in underground facilities, and he just announces me as being in my cave 8 feet below the surface of the planet. I'm not here hiding. Trust me. Let's open up that special line for those in Denver. 818-817-0021. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, you probably don't hear this, but I'm hearing in my headsets a little tiny leprechaun-type thing giggling in my headsets. Absolutely weird. You don't hear it, Jay, do you?
No, I don't.
Now, what can that mean?
I don't know.
Hey, Jay, through everything we've talked about, you have also done some work about the Lord of the Rings, right?
Yep.
In 2012. Explain that before we go to calls.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. If you read the Lord of the Rings, you realize that Tolkien is talking about the end of the Third Age. This great War of the Ring took place at the end of the Third Age. Well, Sharon Rose and I went back and looked into Tolkien's letters, and we found a letter in which he said that the events in Lord of the Rings were not an analogy. They were true events that happened 6,500 to 7,000 years ago. Well, if you take the precession of the equinoxes, the 26,000-year cycle, and divide it into four, then you come out with 6,500 years, which would mean that Tolkien is saying that the end of the Third Age happened 6,500 years ago, which means, of course, that the end of the Fourth Age, according to Tolkien, would be happening just about now, this is exactly what the Mayans are saying. This is the end of the fourth sun and the beginning of the fifth sun. And it's like, well, how did Tolkien ever in his wildest dreams know this? And the only answer that I can come up with is because he was a student of language and a philologist, he probably took the histories of words backwards and discovered a history, a secret history of our race, our planet, embedded in all the languages that he studied, and realized that really there were once hobbits and wizards and a great war at the end of the last age. And of course, we now know that they've actually discovered little midget people that did live about 6,500 years ago.
Yep.
And so Tolkien's one of those guys who is a mystic. Like I was telling you earlier, how they get the ideas first, and he was essentially a mystic masquerading as a scholar, and dictating and telling us about not just the end of the last age, but also that we are about to enter into the end of our own age, which is the end of the age of men, and again, incredibly prescient, because the films of The Lord of the Rings came out. The first one came out just a few months after 9/11. Of course, the second one was called The Two Towers. And just kind of a lot of strange things that go on when you start scratching the surface of what is really happening in Lord of the Rings.
So. I think what we're doing too tonight, Jay, is, you know, it's almost like a puzzle. If you look at pieces of a puzzle scattered all over the table, you have no idea what it looks like. You just put these little pieces of the puzzle together. But eventually, when you stand up and look down on that puzzle, after you've put many of the pieces together, you see the bigger picture. I think that's what we're doing tonight.
That's right. And you know what? This is what's happening at the end of time. We're finally able, through shows like this and the internet, to compare notes. All these different people from all over the world are comparing notes, and for the first time we're seeing everything in a complete whole. And this is changing us as a people, as a species, and that's why I'm essentially an optimist.
All right, let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, for Kathy?
You got it, if that's you, Kathy.
Yeah, hi, George.
Hi.
Nice talking to you. It's my first time to talk to you. I would have come in on the Denver line, but I couldn't get through.
That's okay.
Gentlemen, I've been there.
And what have we seen, Kathy?
Well, it was really so obvious. I mean, I thought everybody did it. Back in 1961, my ex-husband and I were driving to Denver to visit family, and we had to go through this giant tunnel. And the military was everywhere. They had these doors, these rounded kind of doors, inside the more solid part of the tunnel that led into the mountain. And they were coming and going in and out of the doors and stuff. And the line was just like forever. So I was looking around and just looking at the scenery and everything. I'd never been in mountains like that before. I came from Florida. And we got close to the end of through the tunnel. And a military guy stopped us, and he was asking us questions. Who were we? Where were we coming from? Where were we going? What were we going to be doing there? Were we going to be, you know, all kinds of stuff, just regular
strange
stuff.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think military normally asks that, do they?
Well, we didn't know. We never ran into the military in the mountains before. So anyway, they asked us if we'd like to take a tour of their underground facility.
What?
Yes! I'm telling you, they were so obvious, we just thought it was something that went on every day, you know, a tourist attraction or something. So my ex wasn't all that interested because he'd been in the military. He had been in the Army. But I was interested because I've always been kind of interested in warlike stuff and everything. And I thought it sounded, you know, interesting. So they told us to pull out of the, go the rest of the way out of the tunnel, and go down a little ways, and there was off to the left like a great big old space, rock and dirt and stuff, and a little cafe, like a diner where you would stop in and get coffee and donuts and stuff, you know, if you're a trucker or something, and pull into the parking lot there, and then go inside, and they would direct us somewhere to go. So we did. We found a little diner. We made a left, and we pulled into the parking lot area. And we went inside, and I looked around, and it was a neat little place. It was all wooden, but it was kind of old-timey. You know, everything was wood, and well, it was also 1961. That was kind of old-timey, wasn't it? And there was a military guy, a soldier. He was to the back of the place next to a regular-looking door. And so we saw him, and he saw us. And he waved us over, and there were only, I couldn't believe it, there were only about four or five of us that took the tour. I thought they'd be packed, you know.
So were these guys armed, by the way, the military guys?
Yes.
They were, okay.
Yeah, but we didn't think anything of that either. We figured, well, they're military, and they're probably showing off or something. We were very skeptical of the whole thing, you know. We thought, well, what is this, you know? So anyway, the soldier opened up this door, regular door, and it opened up into a big metal, well, it looked like a big metal box is what it looked like. But we looked around, and we could see some divisions in the metal, which would indicate that it was some sort of a movable
made. Modular, something modular. Huh?
Yes, thank you, modular. So we went inside, and my ex is starting to look a little nervous, and he's looking around. But I thought it was exciting. I thought, wow, look at this stuff, you know. And I was looking at the metal, and it was very, it seemed very
thick. Well, but beyond that, Kathy, what was in there? Any equipment or anything like that?
No. There was just some a few buttons, and the soldier operated those. And so he said, all right, everybody step back. Everybody, all five or six of us. So we all stepped back. And he operated the thing, and we were all faced to the front. You know how you, when you get in the elevator, you turn around, you face the doors, and then they close?
Huge, so though.
It was huge, yes. It
yeah.
was really big. I mean, it was tall. It was really tall, and it was really wide. Okay, we must have gone down about, it's been so many years ago. I think we went down about five or six stories. Because we could tell because there was a little light that blipped every time we went by a floor.
All right. So 60 to 75 feet deep, maybe.
I don't know, I guess. Whatever five or six stories
about
are. 10
feet, yeah.
Oh, okay. So we got down, and then we stopped, and it moved real slow. And we got down, and it stopped, and it was heavy. You could just feel the heaviness of the thing. It was huge, and it was heavy. So we stood there, and we heard kind of a drawing noise, like doors opening up, but nothing happened. We were standing there. We're still looking at the doors. And the soldier from behind us said, if everybody will just turn around and walk this way. And we all turned around, and we went into shock. The doors had opened up behind us. And we weren't expecting that. So I said, whoa, is this neat or what? And I went jumping out. And my ex-husband's ready to have a heart attack. He's looking around like, what the, you know, what is going on, you know? And there was like it opened up into a real big, long, metallic hallway. And it was had all kinds of metal, mostly metal, like trunks or cartons, big ones like that, lined up.
Did you see? Did you see any people down there, Kathy?
Oh yeah, we're getting to that. And so you could only go two ways, either off to the left or off to the right. And off to the left, you would have been definitely heading back to where all the traffic would have been six floors up. So we headed off to the right. We followed the soldier. And all this time, boy, I wish I could remember everything he told us. He was telling us all about this facility and what it was for. It's all military. Everybody that's down there lives down there. Yes, they do. They live down there. And he was telling us about these giant doors that we went through. He said they were 6 feet thick. They were solid. There was also some other kind of a backup thing. And I asked, I said, everybody else's, their eyes were as big as saucers. I said, well, why do you need a walls? I mean, you know, like elevator sliding walls or something, if so thick like that, I mean, you know, like you're hardly going to have anybody, you know, mug you or whatever. He said in case of an atomic attack. a nuclear attack, you know. He said atomic.
Yep.
And I said, oh. And the other thing has something to do with stopping the radioactivity, but mainly they were looking to protect themselves from a blast and, I guess, the pressure from...
Well, here's the question, though. Why did they take you down there, Kathy?
It was a tour. Could you believe that? It was a, it was an actual
tour. Let's check in with Jay. Jay, have you heard of anything like this where they actually give you a tour?
Well, I mean, it was 1961, but I would be more... thinking that it was some kind of a psyops where possibly they were seeing what kind of effect that this kind of thing would have. And that's why there was only a few people.
Like a
and
test? They were testing these four people.
Yeah, and they may have actually
brilliant
followed up, you know, over the years to see what effect this had on people. And so that would be my feeling about this whole thing.
Well, you know what? That's an interesting test, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
All right, Kathy, thanks. Let's take a few more calls, and then we'll move on. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's an honor to be on here.
Thank you. Where are you calling from?
This is Chris in Indianapolis.
Okay, Chris.
I have kind of a important question that is first thing that struck me when you guys started talking about this is, do you think the 500 million people are already selected for this big hideaway?
I think the top ones might be, Jay.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they're giving away seats on Noah's Ark as favors to those who help.
Right. And another thing is, what do you think the what your first inkling would be to get in on this? What direction do you think someone would have to point, like military wise?
I think first off, you're going to need quite a bit of money and influence and some skills, and you're going to probably have to pass a battery of tests to make sure that you're okay to be down in there with them, because they don't want any psychopaths or anything to be down there with them. So
even though they may be the psychopaths.
Exactly right. And they may be more afraid of people like themselves. So, I mean, I don't think it's going to be a very pleasant place to be, and I think it's going to be extremely dictatorial and militaristic, and you know, I don't. I, other than that, I don't know. I really don't know. I think that it's an open question as to who is being chosen and for what reasons.
But it may be better than staying on top there, Jay.
Yes, it may be. It certainly might be. Yes, it depends on what's coming our way.
I wonder if they have plans for a talk show host maybe to come along. What do you think? I don't think I would go if they asked me. Now, a lot of people will say,
either.
Come on, yes, you would if it meant saving your life. You know, I'd rather be broadcasting up to the moment of whatever would happen, Jay.
Well, you know, here's the thing, is once you realize that there really isn't such a thing as death, then you're not afraid anymore. And so these guys are scurrying like rats on the Titanic. And because they're so afraid of losing their lives, and so I think, you know, they're really not the bravest of men. I'll just put it that way.
Let's go back now to the Denver hotline. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Susan. I'm calling from Denver.
Hey, Susan. So what do you know about the airport?
Well, I've lived here my whole life, even before people were talking about Cheyenne Mountain being hollowed out. And,
yeah,
of course, the Air Force Academy is right there in the shadow of Cheyenne Mountain with Peterson Air Force Base. When the city was building DIA with the federal government, I worked for the state. And one thing I can contribute that's kind of interesting is it went so far beyond budget and took so long. We even joked about it. DIA stood for done in August, and then, of course, it was the next August, and after that. It took so long that they would dismiss the contractor that was working on a specific part of it and hire a new crew, and then dismiss them and hire another crew to work on a different part. And
You know what? That's the old German formula, by the way. You have many people working on separate things. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Yep. And there were so many crews in different parts, and then they would get replaced with new crews, that people in the state government were sort of asking about why. I mean, there just was not a total a synthesis of knowledge about how it was being built. It was all in discrete parcels, and someone would work there 3 months, and their firm would be dismissed, and that was all they got to know. So
a lot of people
knew pieces of that puzzle, knew timelines of that puzzle, but no one who worked on it really had an overview.
But you're convinced something was going on deep down there.
Well, I think so. And I think for people who haven't been to DIA, it's important to know that it's got this, you know, a great train system that takes you from the terminal to the various concourses. And so there is already, there was an understanding, oh, yeah, well, they're building the trains. Then they go underneath. And isn't that great? We used to go out there when they were building it. They're building a tunnel for trains. Great. But it gave them an opportunity to go a whole lot deeper without anyone really questioning, oh, well, you know.
All right,
why?
Thank you. And, Jay, how many of these places do you think exist around this planet for the Illuminati?
I think that every continent has at least one of them. I think Alice Springs in Australia, and I think, of course, Denver and Dulce here, and I think that they're all over the place.
Okay, hold that thought right there, Jay. Let's come right back in a moment. We'll take final calls as well. Jay, we were talking about how many of these hidden places there may be all around this planet, and you were getting into it, and then the break hit us.
Yeah, well, right after the first book that I wrote, A Monument to the End of Time, came out, we uncovered and revealed these tunnel systems that are ancient, that are in Peru in the Andes, that are huge, hundreds of miles long, that many, many people have been in. And, you know, we were just kind of innocently reporting it. And so the book came out in September, and September of 2000, and by November of 2000, there had been pretty much a coup in Peru, and I forget his name, the Japanese Peruvian president was thrown out of office, and a new president was in office, and he was a skull and bones guy from Yale who became the new president of Peru. And immediately the army began shutting down all the entrances to these caves.
It was Fujimori.
Fujimori, right.
Yeah,
Fujimori was thrown out, and the next guy came in. And so then I was getting reports from people in Peru who said they could no longer go into the cave systems because the military had taken them. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I just know that they seem extremely interested in these things, and they're all over the place. I could do a whole show just on the number of different caves and tunnel systems that the military and other people are very, very interested in, which are all over the world, and including Tibet and Arizona.
Do you think any of them are extraterrestrial?
I don't know. Whatever they are, they're extremely advanced. Sort of like the Krill in that movie from the 50s, that science fiction movie. Forget the name of it now. I know that Richard knows. It's one of his favorite movies. But the Krill were this advanced race that had these underground systems in this planet. And they seem similar to that, very similar, actually, to that. Even the shape of the tunnels is very similar to the shape that the Krill tunnels were. So I don't know. I don't know who it was. I know that it's pretty much evidence that there was somebody in our past extremely advanced. And did they come from Mars? Sure, it could be. Why not?
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah. Hi, George.
Hi.
This is Chris. I'm calling you from Reno, Nevada.
Okay, Chris. Go ahead, sir.
And this is for Jay. You were talking about a film that you're going to be doing about moving over to the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What that is like.
Yes.
And I just wanted to let you know, I had a long time ago, however, I remember it like it happened yesterday, an outer body experience where I had flatlined for approximately 4 minutes. And the weird thing about this is when I was a little kid, you know, I'd go into my parents' room and I'd lay down next to my mom's bed when I was sick. And she'd kind of help me to the bathroom, you know, to throw up. And one of the times off to the bathroom, she didn't follow me into the bathroom. And I was running to the toilet. And the next thing I know, I just, boom, hit the ground. And the next thing I remember was floating out of my body. And it was, the feeling was, there's a feeling of bliss. And like, there was no anxiety about leaving loved ones or any of that. But the weird thing was, is I watched my mom come running in. Now, my mom was a nurse at the time, and my father, who is a, he still is a neurosurgeon, excuse me, and he was just sitting, laying in the bed because he didn't know that anything had happened. So I watched my mother as I'm standing there. You know what you look like, but you're not looking in a mirror at yourself. Mm-hmm. So I was like looking at my body on the ground, and then I was actually able to see my body in a third person. In other words, I was watching my body watch my body on the ground, pointing at it. I was pointing at my body on the ground, and for whatever reason, I was laughing hysterically at it. But I was watching myself do this, and my mother came in and started pounding on my chest to revive me. And she used a couple different maneuvers, I guess, to revive me. And then my father came running in, threw her off, said some words, and then hit me a couple more times in the chest. And the weirdest thing was is I went from third person back into the second person and then just sort of peacefully laid back down into my body. And my, you know, my eyes dilated to the light.
Well, yeah, he sounds like he was on his way.
Well, that's a great story. Yeah, that's a typical NDE, and you know, it's just more evidence that there is a hyperspatial reality that we live in, and that what we think is real just is not real. And I'm completely convinced that this is a completely valid experience, and. You know, how lucky are you to have such a great experience, you know?
Next wild card line, you're on with Jay Widener on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Welcome to the program. There you go.
I wasn't sure it was me. I'm sorry. I have a couple of observations. I live in the Omaha area, and I've been an ex-military family brat, and I've noticed quite a few things happening since the mid-60s to now. And I also have a question after those observations, if that's okay. A lot of things here, the SAC has changed so much, and that's the air base here. A lot of things are being moved off, and areas that were so accessible before are now being closed off. My father, who, as like I said, ex-military, was able to take us underground for a visit, and we've seen quite a few things on that. And I know they must be so much more advanced underneath. That has changed. On 9/11, where did Bush go? He came here. Since then, he's made several visits, more than we've ever seen any politician ever come. And I often thought to myself, was that actually in lieu or to cover up the fact that he's still checking in at base, on the base to see what's progressing there? I know there was a lot of people here in Union Pacific, my family being one of those also as well, who worked a lot of overtime in the what they call the bunkers. which is underground, very high security. All, you know, that's all there involved, them changing that. And you can always also feel, especially in the wee hours of the morning while we're listening to Coast of Course, deep vibrations that feel like underground vibrations and air changes. I'm wondering if this is very similar to what Jay may be observing in the Denver area, and if there's any connection there.
Well, actually, I'm quite familiar with the SAC base there in Omaha, and from what I've heard, at least 60 stories underground, and I think there's probably a tunnel, to be honest with you, going from the SAC base there at Offutt all the way to Denver, and you're probably hearing construction on this system.
This low hum that so many people around this country hear, Jay.
Yes, that's right, and every time you hear the low hum, that's probably what it is, so... And you'll find it goes away after a while, and that means they're done.
First-time caller line, you're up. Hi there.
Yes, my name is James from Dallas, Texas. How are
Hello,
you?
Hello, James. Good.
I must preface the conversation by saying I wanted you to expand this evening before I even knew Jay was to be your guest on the Illuminati and the Freemasons. That being said, did a little research on the Illuminati. They're quite old. I thought these people were just around 50, 60 years.
Oh, no, they're up there.
It seems they're 260-plus years old.
tell me about that.
Yeah, my question is were either of you able to catch the press conference that Philip Schneider gave, I believe it was in 1999 or 1998?
I don't think he...
No.
No, he didn't. I think he died a little earlier than that, didn't he?
Was it? Okay, maybe it was.
Yeah, I have seen the press conference, the videotape of it, and then he died a couple months later. So, yes, I have seen it.
Okay. He spoke of his work with the Los Alamos Project in Dulce, New Mexico.
Yes.
You could tell that he was injured some way, don't know how.
Oh, he showed the injury.
He died in 96.
Yeah, 96, right. Okay. They never said or never knew what brought about his demise.
He was killed by a burglar, I think.
And the fact remains that he was an attempt on his life was made 12 previous times.
Yeah. No, he was one of those guys that when you watch that videotape, he's so sober and so, no nonsense that you just have to believe him, you know.
Schneider was found in his Oregon apartment. He had been apparently dead for several days, reportedly had a rubber hose wrapped three times around his neck.
Yeah, and the Oregon police say that it was a burglary, but it's still an open case, as I think that's the case, yeah.
Officially, suicide is the stated cause of death.
Ah.
How about that?
Well, they've changed.
Even though there are a lot of people who think he was murdered.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There was apparently 13 murder attempts on his life during his time.
Yep.
All right, James, thanks for the call. A couple more callers, and we'll wrap things up for the night. Let's go to our wild card line. Hi there.
Hi. Well, I guess the screener put me through because he had two people with the exact same story. That lady who called about the tour, I was on hold when she came on the air.
Okay.
I told your screener that I took a tour 30 years ago, almost verbatim what she said, except I spent 15 years of my life researching what the heck it was I saw.
And this was that Cheyenne?
No, this was a different location within the United States.
Okay. Tell me what you saw.
Now, this is incredible. Look at this. It's hard to tell where to start. But first of all, I took an elevator. It's about my 5 to 10 stories down. I went into this. Well, I found out they are these things, what they're drilling these tunnels to are empty, ancient volcanic vents that are the size of small cities. All they have to do is drill a tunnel to these huge, gigantic openings. They're old volcanic vents is what they're doing. I went in one of these old volcanic vents, It's incredible. The ceilings in these places are, they're stalactites. If you know what those are, you know, cement, look like icicle things that are like rock.
That hang, yeah.
Yeah. I was down in one of these, like I said, I went down 10 stories down, and it was a tour about 30 years ago. And there was a water, it was so large, the ceiling was about 100 feet in some areas tall, and there's a waterfall. That's how big this place was underground. And there's a water reserve. And to the right, I saw a sign that said Naval Research Facility, Naval Intelligence Research Facility. And that caught my attention. I'm like, what's the Naval Intelligence doing here underground 10 stories? And I talked to some guys. I got some information. They told me this. They said, when you go underground this deep, there's gamma rays from the sun and radiation and stuff. When you go down here, because when I was down there, I was completely relaxed. I never feel like this my entire life. I feel completely and totally relaxed and at ease. They said that it actually boosts your IQ about 15 to 20% being down here due to some sort of gamma radiation from the sun or whatever. It seems sort of weird. But once you're down there, it is so bizarre that you feel like a completely different person. But I did research, and I found out that we're using satellites now. I mean, not 30 years ago, but now in our time now, we have satellites that actually could penetrate the Earth and look for oil in the ground. You know about that, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Now, what they did is they accidentally stumbled across these huge, gigantic, empty spaces in the ground.
That's right.
The volcanic vents that they found with these satellites, and that's what they're drilling to. They're drilling tunnels to these gigantic volcanic vents that are the size of cities, and they're connecting them all together like a hamster trail or something. It's incredible.
And they're doing this all around the planet.
Yep, they're not necessarily volcanic vents. They appear to have been, in many cases, intelligently constructed.
Forbidden Planet's the name of that movie.
Forbidden
about the
Planet,
krills.
Thank you.
Why?
They appear to be intelligently constructed a long time ago. And you're absolutely right. They're connecting the entire system together with their tunneling.
All right, let's go to our next wild card line. Your turn. Thanks for holding. Hi.
Hi, aloha. It's Stuart here on Maui. How are you?
Stuart, good. Thank you.
Good. George, I very much appreciate your guest this evening, and my question may be a little off, appear to be a little bit off the meat of this conversation in the beginning. However, in the long run, I assure you it's relevant. Jay, are you aware of the fact that J.R.R. Tolkien spent 10 years of his life, evidently, working his way upstream toward a source of information that he became very close to by virtue of spending that 10 years learning the Finnish language?
I certainly am, and I'm very familiar with several Finnish scholars who believe that the Finnish language contains many of these secret histories that I was describing earlier.
Well, I would suggest they're absolutely correct. And would be very happy to have some further conversation with you in this regard, perhaps by email.
Yeah, you can go to my website, jaywidener.com. It's right there on the coast site, and you can contact me right on the email.
East of the Rockies. Let's see if we can squeeze you in. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello, George. Roger.
Go, Roger. Okay.
Happy belated birthday, and I don't
think
coincidences
so much.
Either. And I believe there might be Illuminati on Earth, but I also believe that someone is in charge of this planet Earth, and who's been around for a long, long time, and they may be coming back to pick up whoever they want to pick up someday.
You may be right about that.
I don't think, and they may have another planet already prepared for these people, and I don't think they're going to be real picky, or I think they will be a little picky on who they're going to choose to take on.
Let's wrap this up with your comments on his comments, Jay.
Well, that very well could be true, and I think that if there is an exterior force coming to do that, I have a funny feeling that they're not going to be interested in the politicians and the people that think that they have a seat on the ark. They're going to be picking people for their high attributes of compassion and spiritual awareness and things that are really, you know, human traits that are good, and that's my feeling.
All right, Jay, thanks so much for being on the program. You're definitely part of the December 21st, 2012 group, okay?
Great. Thanks so much, George.
It's coming up, isn't it? For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smithy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.